From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Kermit Patterson writes that science is not only a quest for information, it's also competition between paradigms or models for understanding nature. In that vein, Patterson has written Fossil Men, The Quest for the Oldest Skeleton and the Origins of Humankind, the epic story of Artie, a human ancestor more than a million years older than the famous Lucy. Patterson, who spent nearly a decade reporting fossil men, including trips in the field in Ethiopia with the team that discovered Artie. He joins us now to tell us the story of what Discover Magazine calls equal parts biography and adventure novel. Kermit Patterson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, good morning. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. I wanted to start with Charles Darwin, who, well, many people call the father of evolution. He had theorized that humans had this big three going. We had big brains, we had tool use, and erect walking simultaneously, kind of as a package, as you write in your book. But a whole bunch of discoveries destroyed that theory, culminating with Lucy, who showed that upright walking came at least a million years before big brains or stone implements. And now this new skeleton that has been unearthed back in the early 90s, Artie. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so just as a bit of background for your readers, Artie is the name of a single skeleton. It was found in Ethiopia in 1994. It's 4.4 million years old. It was discovered in a place called the Afar Depression, which is part of the the Great Rift System in Eastern Africa. And it's in kind of the northern part of Ethiopia. It's kind of a low-lying basin that, because of its geological conditions, tends to be really productive fossil territory. And this already was found less than 50 miles from where Lucy had been found about two decades earlier. Artie was 1.2 million years older than Lucy and included a lot of body parts like hands and feet and skull that had been missing from the Lucy skeleton. So it was a real scientific opportunity to see what came before Lucy, but also to examine the evolution of these different parts of the body, the hand, the foot, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. And when someone unearths a Lucy or an Artie, what is the time element involved in getting confirmation, in getting the special testing and getting all the other scientists involved? What is involved in making that happen?
Okay, well, this was really eye-opening to me to see how this science works in the field. You know, I think people have this idea that, you know, fossil hunter walks along and boom, there's a skeleton, or they just start digging and hit something. And it doesn't really work that way. In this part of Ethiopia, it's kind of an erosional geology. So basically, this part of the Rift Basin is just like water basically flows down the slopes into this basin and lays down these layers of geology. You know, there's layers of ancient lake shores and then like some volcanic ashes come on that. So just imagine like a big layer cake, and creatures die. They, a very small number of them turn to fossils and then get buried in this big layer cake. Then over time, as the rifting continues, there's geological faulting. These layers are exposed again by both faulting and then erosion, by more rainwater coming down. So, basically cuts into that ancient layer cake and then exposes a fossil. But when it's exposed, it's very rarely like a nice intact skeleton. It's usually little pieces falling out one at a time. And oftentimes, they've been all the skeletons have been disarticulated, broken up. And so you might get like a tooth or a finger bone or a broken finger bone. And so the surveying is done by sending people out to walk across these outcrops, across these geological exposures, looking at the ground. And believe me, it is not easy to see this stuff on the ground. The ground looks like, you know, kind of like a gravel driveway, right? Sometimes, you know, it's like dirt and, you know, dung and, you know, occasional plants. It's desert, but there are plants there. And, you know, they're really good fossil hunters. They just have this uncanny ability to spot broken pieces of bone, things that you or I would just walk over without seeing it, you know, be blind to it. But the really good people can spot things and are able to do the sort of mental calculation to recognize that that thing there that looks like a rock is really a bit of skull or really a broken tooth, like a quarter of a tooth or whatever. So anyway, these guys walk across the desert and, you know, do the surveying. And then if they see something, you know, they'll stop and then look and then start intensively surveying that area, crawling that area. This particular team, this is called the Middle Atlas Research Group, is led, well, it has several leaders, but the chief sort of fossil guy is a fellow named Tim White from UC Berkeley. And he is has a well-earned reputation of being a very methodical guy with who's a real stickler for details. So he will get his teams down on hands and knees oftentimes, you know, elbow to elbow to crawl, you know, yeah, like you would in a crime scene, for example. And, well, you know, you crawl one direction, you crawl the other direction, and then if you start finding more pieces, then, you know, the little signals go off that, oh, maybe there's something more here. Right. And that's exactly what happened.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Kermit Pattison. He has written and researched for a decade a new book called Fossil Men, The Quest for the Oldest Skeleton and the Origins of Humankind. And it's really interesting what you say, Kermit, about how, you know, a paleoanthropologist can go walking along, you know, the desert, or in this case, the bed of, you know, what is now dry used to be wet, and see even, I think you said, a portion of a tooth or something like that. And, you know, yeah, I'm looking at a picture right now of Lucy and the bones that make up Lucy. And, you know, there just aren't, what do we say? We have 226 bones in the human body. There are maybe, well, I don't know, just a fraction of that. So it's very interesting to see what they can put together and then what they can assess from that. So while you're one of the protagonists in your story, Tim White has his team down on hands and knees, it's certainly what it takes. Can we go into sort of the differences between Lucy and Artie? I mean, we've got Lucy that is 3.2 million years ago existed,
right,
and then Artie 4.4 million years ago. It's fascinating. What do we know about Artie in terms of the ability to walk and, you know, the long arms and the long toes and that sort of thing that maybe we didn't see later on in Lucy?
Okay. Well, first of all, Lucy did not have feet, but and some other parts of the lower limb. But there were a lot of other broken individuals of Lucy's species that were able to fill out that picture. Mm. So it's pretty clear now that Lucy was a biped, an upright walker. You know, whether that species also spent, you know, some time in trees is, you know, sort of something that's still being debated. But it's pretty clear that Lucy was walking upright in a way that's sort of well down the path to the weird way that modern humans walk around. And so the big question with Artie was like, you know, how old is this distinctively human trait of walking upright? And the big shocker with Artie was this is a creature that still was partially arboreal. It had an opposable toe. This is one of the first pieces that was cleaned by Tim White. He kind of honed, even when the bones kind of came into the museum, Because, you know, they don't, when they're in the field, they're just like, the whole focus is collection, not interpretation, because they're, you know, running out of tide, they're running out of daylight, it's dangerous, the field season's running short. So when you're in the field, you're just like, you know, grab the stuff as carefully as you can,
right,
get it secure, get it back to the museum so you can do the study. But in the museum, he picked the first bone he wanted to clean, and it was a foot bone that he knew would be revealing about whether this creature had a grasping toe. And sure enough, it did. And that was a big wow moment because, you know, this is a creature that was partially arboreal. But, you know, there were lots of other evidence that it was something of the human family, too. So everyone knew that there, we had an arboreal ancestor somewhere in the deep past, but no one had found it yet until Ardipithecus. Now, there's another interesting thing about Ardi, though, in that while it did have this grasping toe and a lot of other features that were clearly arboreal, it also appeared to walk upright. And there are a lot of other features in the skeleton to suggest that it was erect, walking on the ground. So therefore, it appears to be this transitional creature that is taking, you know, the first steps to this distinctively human way of walking erect, but yet is still, you know, like our ape ancestors and our ape relatives, still spending a lot of time up in the branches.
Wow. This is an incredible story. Ardi, 4.4 million years ago, was human, but arboreal, as you say, which means hanging out in trees. So this really comes up against one of the scientists that you feature in the story. And this is the great thing about your story is that you look at all these wild scientists. But it just brings me to Owen Lovejoy, who was a creationist, and then he became a paleoanthropologist. That's got to be one of the most interesting things you came across.
Yeah, well, Owen is a wonderful guy to talk to. He's gone through a lot of transformations in his life. He's a very deep thinker about evolution, quite controversial, quite unapologetic about his views. But anyway, yeah, he was raised in Kentucky. I don't think his upbringing was probably that unusual for people of his generation in that part of the world. But, you know, he just kind of grew up in the Methodist church like everyone else did and never really questioned the creation story. And you talk to Owen and he he's about atheist now, of course. But, you know, all those biblical verses still find their way into his speech, you know, hiding under a bushel light or doing that. But anyway, he went to Wheaton, which was, you know, the school, the former institution of Billy Graham. And then he sort of had this conversion experience, except he, you know, converted to atheism. And then went through this intellectual journey and eventually became an anthropologist. And one of his first really immersive experiences with skeletons was he had befriended a professor who was excavating ancient Native American cemeteries in Ohio. And, you know, I mean, nowadays this is quite controversial, and I don't think this would happen the same way anymore. But Owen was, you know, dug up hundreds upon hundreds of skeletons. And just when he told me about this, you could just still hear the wonder in his voice about the things they found, because everyone is different. You know, when they'd see pathologies, they'd see evidence that, you know, this one had arthritis, this one had cancer, this one had a broken bone that healed, this one had been scalped, you know, this one had an arrowhead lodged in it. And I think he just was filled with wonder about why these skeletons looked as they did. And he became an anthropologist, and he became, incidentally, one of the first people to really develop the field of biomechanical analysis of skeletons. I mean, up until this point, you know, anthropologists they would kind of opine about things, but there were very few to none who really had biomechanical insights into the skeletons. And so another interesting twist in Owen's story is he worked with these people, biomedical engineers, who made artificial joints, you know, artificial knees and that sort of thing. And, you know, those people had to understand biomechanics. So Owen would, like, read engineering textbooks and that sort of thing. And, you know, just develop these insights into what, mechanically, what made a biped and how was a biped, you know, walking on 2 feet like we do, different from a arboreal creature mm-hmm. who climbs or walks with 4 limbs on the ground. And so anyway, that's... Can I keep going for another 30 seconds, or I could stop. You have another question, but here's where the next twist.
We have in lots of
Owen's
questions.
Story comes in. What?
We have lots of questions. So why don't we move on? I wanted to talk to you about science and technology, how that is used to date some of these fossils that come out of the ground. Certainly, I heard about radiometric dating. That was something new to me. Can you talk about the technology that you all use to ascertain how old these fossils are?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm the UL. I'm just, you know, a journalist or author reporting this, so I'm not an actual radiometric scientist or anything like that. So I just don't want to be going beyond my brief here. But anyway. So you've probably heard about techniques like carbon-14 dating, where scientists can directly determine the date of certain objects. But anyway, carbon-14 dating only works stuff. You know, and I forget how what the range is now. You know, 50,000 years, 100,000 years, something like that. When you get to stuff of the age of Artie or Lucy, all the biological material has turned to stone, so you can't directly date those bones. So what the geologists and the paleontologists have to do is date them by their geological context. Now, in this part of Africa, you do that with volcanic ashes because there's a lot of volcanoes up there for long series of factors, but basically it's because it's the edge of these separating rift plates, and volcanoes tend to pop up there. And these things periodically erupt and then spew out ash and lava, which covers the ground. And if you look at like a layer cake in like a river cut or something, you'll see like layer after layer of these ashes. Now, these ashes you can date with radiometric dating, basically through, there's been a series of techniques, but basically with isotope geology, the geologist or geochronologist can give you a pretty accurate age on lavas and ashes. And so if you find an ash, you know, above a fossil and you have a date on it, and you find a ash below a fossil with a certain date on it, you know that that's your age bracket. And in this particular part of the world where Artie was found, this team has put a lot of effort into figuring out the geology and the stratigraphy. Okay. And anyway, they were able to date, you know, because of the ashes and lavas above and below Artie, they were able to really precisely narrow down that date to that 4.4 million years.
You know, the most complete example of a Tyrannosaurus rex was unearthed, I think, in North Dakota. It was Sue. And when they pulled her out of the rock, they were able to determine what she had for breakfast that morning before she died. And I wanted to know, with advanced techniques and with certainly advances in genomic sequencing, maybe there's no DNA on these bones, but does the advanced techniques of genomic sequencing help people determine how old these bones are?
Well, not directly with these bones. You know, again, no one's gotten ancient DNA out of anything nearly this old. I mean, they've done some remarkable things with ancient DNA with, you know, Neanderthals and stuff, and they've squeezed, you know, DNA out of stuff that is, you know, far, far older than anyone would have thought. But none of that has come close to fossils of this age. So genomics, you know, with fossils of this age, the genetic work really comes into play when figuring out the shape of our family tree. you know, because genetics are useful for figuring, for making estimates about when the ancestors of humans split from the ancestors of chimpanzees and bonobos, our closest relatives. So genetics are quite relevant when it comes to that. And then, you know, that gives you a so-called split time. And, you know, if you have an age estimate for a split time and then a date on your fossil, you can begin to, you know, make some guesses about how close you are to the chimp-human split or the R split with gorillas or what have you.
We're speaking with Kermit Pattison. His book is Fossil Men, The Quest for the Oldest Skeleton and the Origins of Humankind. So in the book, I'm looking now at a picture of Artie next to Lucy. And one of the big differences that you notice is a much more complete set of bones within the skull, including teeth. And this takes me to a Japanese paleoanthropologist named Suwa, and one of the foremost experts in the world on fossilized teeth. And he's part of the story. So can you tell us a little bit about his involvement?
Yeah. So again, he's a very understated character. He's very humble. You know, I have to confess, I have not met the man personally. He's in Japan, and then he comes to Ethiopia, but I never overlapped with him there. He is a guy who does not seek publicity. In fact, his colleagues kind of laugh that, like, when they do a press conference, again, is quite happy to not be there. but, you know, he might seem on the surface like not a very interesting character, but as I talk to all of his colleagues, they all seem to be in awe of Gensuwa, because he's very humble and unassuming, but he has this encyclopedic knowledge and this very quiet, methodical absorption in his material. And, you know, all these people, like, you know, they'll say, my God, you know, you talk to him and he'll start describing a fossil, and it's like he's got this photographic memory. He's describing every contour of things. He's also very much of a workaholic. So when he was reconstructing Artie's skull, you know, from all these pieces, I mean, this thing looked like it had been run over by a steamroller, and his job was to put all these broken pieces together. Ken was telling me that, he really loves to immerse himself in a task. And he, because of his position at the University of Tokyo Museum, had all these administrative responsibilities and teaching responsibilities. So people would come in and talk to him, you know, what do we do about this or that, this administrative question. He would, you know, dutifully have to answer them and do his job, but he just couldn't get the work done on the skull. So his solution was just to stay up all night, wait till everyone to go home, and then he'd go in and just, like, immerse himself in this skull. And he'd stay working until the train stopped running, and so then he would, you know, go maybe sleep at a hotel nearby for a couple hours, go back to his office early, and then work, you know, for another few hours before the regular work crew came in. So that's again, I mean, he's very absorbed in what he does. He's very not in the mold of the kind of more combative or outspoken members of his profession. But the people who could actually understand Yen just speak of him with awe.
I wanted to ask you about other species of humans. You mentioned in your book that since Artie was discovered in 94, the family's been expanded as far as right. Other human families. Were there competing humans and basically the people that are here today are the ones that survived?
Well, this is a hugely controversial question within the field. And you know, it comes down to just how much diversity was there within our human family. And this has been an issue for a long time. I mean, you've probably heard this idea of a bushy tree, you know, and this is a metaphor that sort of really took root in, you know, the 70s, 80s onwards. And that seems to be really the dominant idea right now. But, you know, there's another view, which is, you know, put on by a number of scholars. You know, Tim White is one of the most outspoken advocates of this view. But, and that is that the bushiness of our family has been greatly exaggerated for a number of reasons. I mean, and some of them are due with the ambition of people in the field, because if you say, hey, I found a new species, you get a lot of attention. You might get a cover story in, you know, a prominent journal. You get headlines. If you find the same skeleton and say, this is another of Lucy's species or another of Arnie's species or whatever, you know, it's like ho-hum. You know, people just don't get excited in the same way. But if it's something new and weird, they do get excited. So many people in the scholarly community feel that there's been a taxonomic inflation, so-called taxonomic inflation, which basically means people are declaring things that really aren't new species. They're just variants of species we've already seen. Now, there's another issue here that's a scientific issue that's separate from the sort of publicity piece, and that is that any species, you know, including humans, including modern apes, exhibits a big range of anatomical variation. So, you know, everyone alive on the Earth today is a so-called modern human, Homo sapiens. But, you know, there's a lot of variation. You know, someone who's in Inuit from the northern latitudes is, you know, looks different from someone who's from an equatorial population, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we humans are actually not that diverse. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, chimpanzees, for example, have a lot more genetic variation than we do.
Oh, that's interesting.
Most other primate species have a lot more genetic variation than we do. So you go into the deep past, and, you know, a lot of these species, you know, we only have, you know, a few examples of you know, whatever the species is. And so it may be that with some of these ancient species, they're all part of the same species or the same big breeding pool, but there's just a lot of morphological or let's physical variation.
Sure.
Between them.
Sure. Well, great.
I mean, like take modern gorillas. I mean, you a male gorilla is about twice the size of a female gorilla. So, I mean, the bones are mostly shaped the same, but there's huge size differences. And, you know, in other species, there's the same thing. So anyway, long story short, there is, you know, certainly a huge expansion in the number of species. And without question, some of those are truly things that are different. But, you know, my suspicion is that some of that proliferation of species is just putting new labels on things we already have seen.
Kermit Patterson has written Fossil Men, The Quest for the Oldest Skeleton and the Origins of Humankind. Kermit, we want to thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Kermit.
Oh, it's my great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. And hey, tune in next week.